So welcome to the second installment in the Book of Maccabees. Last week, we didn't actually even open the Book of Maccabees, and we spent the entire time talking about the historical events surrounding the story of Hanukkah, because, if you didn't hear that yet, that's okay, but you can definitely appreciate the Book of Maccabees by understanding the history of the region, and by realizing that the Book of Maccabees is co-opting the history to tell its own story. And so what we're going to do tonight is take a look at the first book of Maccabees. We are only going to explore the first two chapters, partly because those are the two interesting ones. They basically tell you everything you need to know about the character of the first book of Maccabees by looking at the first two chapters. So that's basically what we're going to do. I will say a word of warning in advance, that when it comes, even though this is technically not Tanakh, and when it comes to studying Tanakh, at a certain point, you just can't escape. You have to read things, and you have to kind of slowly comment on those things that you are reading. So sometimes you have to do the boring stuff in order to hopefully yield really interesting results. So this may not be the most energetic and exciting of classes we've ever done at the shul. It's going to be a lot of everyone take a few moments to read. And then once you've all read, we'll kind of come back together and talk a bit about what we just read. But hopefully it will yield really, really, really interesting things and enrich everyone's Hanukkah. Just a bit about the Book of Maccabees. There are actually, like, I think, four books of Maccabees. At a certain point, the quality of books of Maccabees really start to dwindle. This week we're focusing on the first book of Maccabees. The next week we're focusing on the second book of Maccabees because the two really are at tension with one another. The first book of Maccabees was originally written in Hebrew. By all accounts, though we don't have it, a beautiful biblical Hebrew. As you'll see very quickly as you start reading the book of Maccabees, it intentionally was not written in Greek. It does not like Greek. It does not like anything Greek whatsoever. It was originally written in Hebrew. The Hebrew was then translated into Greek, and because this is an apocryphal work rather than a book of actual Tanakh, and it was preserved by the church fathers, Jews really didn't care about it, and so the Greek translation was preserved. This means that maybe for the first time ever, the text from the Book of Maccabees that you have on the sheet is not from a JPS translation, but from the NSRV, which is the New Standard Revised Version, which is basically the Christian Bible's English translation, because A, it's the Book of Maccabees, so there's no worry of kind of, you know, sometimes the NSRV kind of translates things theologically that lends themselves to a Christian audience, but they ain't doing that here. Second, it was copy and pastable, which is really really what makes a good translation of Tanakh online is simply, can you copy and paste it with relative ease? And that was the case here. The best translation, maybe from our perspective, which is the Anchor Bible translation, you can't copy and paste without doing a lot of work after that. So we will be reading that version of the text. A little bit about why it's not in Tanakh. One of the simplest reasons is it's post-era of Tanakh. Tanakh ends with the Purim story and with kind of Ezra and Nehemiah and with the Jews coming back to the land of Israel, ready to build the second temple. As we will see in the Book of Maccabees, it picks up after that period of time. And so the simple reason why it was not included in Tanakh is simply because it's not part of the era of Tanakh. The process of canonization at a certain point cuts off, and kind of all stories after that, the apocryphal works for a whole variety of reasons, once something was clearly written in the Second Temple period, it was excluded from Tanakh. Also, and this is something we'll focus on a lot more next week, and I've mentioned kind of before, Chazal do not like the Hanukkah story. This is why they tell a different Hanukkah story, and that's why we celebrate a completely different event than the actual events of the Hanukkah story. But again, more on that next week. So without further ado, what I kind of want to do now is encourage everyone to just take a couple of minutes. So what you'll see is the actual prime sheet is the Book of Maccabees, and yes, you can all weep when you realize just how much text it is. But again, there's literally no other way to do this without just being like, oh, take a look at source, verse 2, take a look at verse 4, and that's actually even worse. So this is the kind of thing that my 11th graders would cry about, but I'm assuming that's not going to happen here. And if so, they have to deal with it 45 minutes a day, 4 days a week, so, like, you know, much worse for them. But basically, you'll see just right now, it's divvied into paragraphs. Some paragraphs are bigger than others. Right now we have you know, a decent chunk of paragraphs. So we're just going to take a couple of minutes for everyone to read through just this first paragraph. It's verses 1 through 10 of the first book of Maccabees. Everyone take a couple of minutes and we'll regroup once everyone is done. So these first 10 verses are surprisingly, they have a surprising amount in them lying just beneath the surface. So it does kind of set up the historical thing. And a good thing to bear in mind is, more or less, the first book of Maccabees does a decent job with the history. And we spoke last week about the history, and I did mention then that the books of Maccabees do a very good job of corroborating the history. They don't really fudge it. It's the, as what we're going to see today, it's really the additional components of the story that they tell that's really very important. But there are subtle ways this rearranges the history to underscore certain themes that the first book of Maccabees wants to raise. Yes, Stephen.
Are the factual parts of this supported by Greek histories, by other sources?
Yes, so most of what this says and most of what the book of First Maccabees describes is corroborated with enough sources. So again, we have a good handle on the history of this story. And there's little reason that we're going to see in a second that there is something it gets wrong, though it's not its fault. But there is something it gets wrong. But by and large, it gets things right. Just by the way, I mentioned last week a word on the fact that we always use the term Greeks, and that's incorrect, because they were the Seleucids, and they were their own kingdom, and their capital was in, like, modern-day Turkey, Syria. They were culturally Greek. So it's kind of similar to how, like, French people will talk about Americans, like, regardless of, like, you speak English, like, and they don't like you, you are an American. Oh, I'm sorry, you're French. You know this better than anyone. You know what Americans are, and you don't have to have been from America. This is even more perfect. But, you know, Europeans, when they talk about Americans, you don't have to live in America. You can merely be a Western person who's a bit brash speaking English, and you are an American. Similarly, Greeks in the Hanukkah story, it's a cultural thing. What's really interesting is the rabbinic word and the Jewish word, the Jewish kingdom that describes people from the Seleucids is Yavan, which translates as Greece, but they aren't using it to mean Greece, they're using it to mean Seleucid. And so actually, and we see this actually in the first verse, so we see after Alexander, son of Philip the Macedonian, this is Alexander the Great, who came from the land of Kittim, it gives a different country of origin for Alexander the Great. In other words, the actual Greek person gets a different country to distinguish between Yavan. Yavan is Seleucid, whereas Kittim is kind of like Greece. I mean, there's a whole thing you can do about Kittim and its other appearances in Tanakh and what it might mean and what First Maccabees is doing here, which we aren't going to focus on. But Yavan then gets always translated as Greece because Yavan correctly translates as Greece, but that's not actually the correct term. Just like someone from Europe using the term American, technically, that means most of you guys around this table, but, and therefore it would be a correct translation, but that's not actually what it means, because an American could also mean me or you. You know, it works the same way. So that's actually the origin of this confusion is purely the word used in the text itself, and the word always used by Chazal, Yavan, which correctly means Greece, but never was actually the intent of Chazal to describe the Greeks. It's not the Greeks, it's the Seleucids. Seleucids, S-E-L-E-U-C-I-D, they are Greek, culturally Greek, but very much Middle Eastern in nationality, but you get what I mean. Like the
culture, origin.
Well, culturally they're Greek, but like if you
in
walk
origin,
past,
origin,
yeah, if you walk past someone on the street, you wouldn't think, oh, that's a Greek person. You would think, oh, that's a Middle Eastern gentleman. And that's exactly this story.
So it's going to be the Seleucid is the empire, but Egypt, what is today,
yeah.
in Turkey, called Palestine.
Or, yeah, exactly.
And Syria.
Exactly.
Yavan.
That's the point. Their founder was Seleucus. And every king for a while is either Seleucus or Antiochus. Their capital was Antioch. Another really important thing, by the way, in this first verse is how it frames Alexander the Great, which is actually really cool. He defeated King Darius, Daryavish. Daryavish is one of the heroes of Tanakh. So he is connected to being a descendant of Esther. So he is the king who allows the building of the second Beit HaMikdash. If you're looking for kind of rulers who are heroes of Jewish people, he takes kind of one of the top slots. What the first book of Maccabees is therefore already setting this up is the whole Greek kingdom. Alexander the Great took the throne from one of the good guys. In other words, it questions the whole legitimacy of Alexander the Great as being a good guy. His entire kingdom rests on something disapproved of by God, because Daryavish, Darius, was approved of by God. There are several Nevi'im. The later Nevi'im love Daryavish. He's wonderful in their eyes. So this is someone who defeated God's approved ruler of the region. And what this is already setting up is that eventually when the Hashmonaim and the Maccabees take the throne themselves, it was always an illegitimate throne being held by other people. Alexander the Great is thus cast almost as the first usurper of many in this story, but he is cast as a usurper. We're supposed to boo him because he defeated the good guy. At the beginning of the story, we already know we're not supposed to like him. What's actually really interesting and is a major misunderstanding throughout history is verses 5 through, 7 and a bit more, which is basically Alexander knew he was going to die and he decided to crowd everyone around him and appoint his successor. That never happened. Alexander the Great never left any successor. What actually happened was Seleucus was one of the people to kind of seize a lot of the power, and his propaganda went into action to basically convince everyone he had been appointed by Alexander the Great. And so this book of Maccabees here just assumes what there are plenty of historians of this era who repeat this story, despite the fact that that's not what happened, because they bought the propaganda, and basically this cast Seleucus as the appointed anointee of Alexander, who's also a bad guy. But the point is that that's not actually what happened, but it's buying into the story that was told by Seleucus. So we know that the first book of Maccabees is running with the history that they believed of that time. But again, this is not an intentional miscue of history. It's an unintentional, because they don't have the advantage we do of being able to look back at history and actually get a better sense. But this is, and this only further casts how evil Antiochus is, and this is why it's so important to establish Alexander the Great was bad, and then he appointed bad guys in his stead, and so we know already at this point everyone is evil and everyone is bad. Sarah.
You said that there was this idea that he had appointed the one person, but here it's saying that he split it up among several, and they each put on their own crown.
Yeah, so Seleucus takes Seleucus is our main guy, because he's the Seleucid king. So yeah, the kingdom does get split into multiple chunks, but it was not a peaceful transfer of power. It was whoever, slit the last person's throat took control of that region, and Seleucus was good at that. We get introduced to Antiochus. I mentioned last week Epiphanes was parodied into Epimanes or Epimenes, which means he was crazy because he was very Roman, and his people at the time thought he was really strange for all the things he did, which we spoke a lot more about last week. But basically, the first few verses, apart from really trying to sway our emotions, certain ways to think about certain people, just lay out what is a really good, rough, accurate description of how Antiochus came to power. And, skips over a lot of the stuff that we spoke about last week. But that is basically the main thrust of these first verses. Larry.
I just wanted to comment that from a literary perspective, distinct echoes to me of the opening of Esther. You have a king, he conquers 127 provinces, the world is at his feet, he celebrates.
Yeah. And the commentator who writes the commentator who writes the commentary, the guy who writes the commentary to the Anchor Bible, talks about the long biblical sentence. I can't remember the exact term he uses, but it's a classic kind of trope within the historical biblical literature to basically do what is a giant sentence. It's almost like the movie where, you know, at the beginning of the movie, the screen is black and they just flash up like the preamble. So, you know, like who's being oppressed, who's the king, who are all the important names you need to know in the beginning. So this first paragraph is basically that. It just sets it up, but it lets us know, just as like some movies now would put like in red text, the bad guy. So you already know, oh, that's in red. He's going to be bad. So here instead, he conquered Dariavish, which serves the same purpose, but that sets up everything else. And so we'll now take a couple of moments to read the next two paragraphs. So it's verses 11 through 19. So the other thing that the first two chapters really serve as a nice intro to is it's like biblical parallels 101. And what you'll see throughout, and it's harder because we only have the English, but it's also very clear and obvious that the author of the book of First Maccabees has Tanakh in front. And it's going to be explicit in the second chapter. Like he literally calls who he's describing. But he's just like thumbing through Tanakh. And every time he wants to draw attention to a certain biblical theme, he literally copies out the verse. So if you take a look at verse 11 of the book of Maccabees. In those days, certain renegades came out from Israel and misled many, saying, "Let us go and make a covenant with the Gentiles around us. For since we separated from them, many disasters have come upon us. And if you take a look at the additional source sheet, so source number one is from Sefer Dvarim, where Moshe warns the people, "Ki yisitcha achicha ben imecha o vincha o vitcha o eshetcha chekecha o re'echa asher kenafshecha beset elemor." Someone close to you comes up to you in secret and says, "Nelcha v'na'avda Elohim acherim," come let us worship other gods, "asher lo yadata atava avotecha," whom you nor your fathers knew. It's riffing off this idea of, again, in a couple of places in the Torah, this place that I put, and in another place, the idea that someone comes along and is like, come on, let's do something different. That is, it's a very clear call to this first book of Maccabees wants us to know, these are the bad guys. The other bad guys, because there's a lot of bad guys and very few good guys. I spoke about this last week, and I don't want to repeat this again so much, but it's really complicated to describe the Hellenistic Jews as all that, especially in an environment where we try to thread the needle between religious observance and embracing modernity. And it is very clear and obvious that without trying to be too anachronistic, but it's actually not being that anachronistic, that many of the Hellenistic Jews were still observant. We spoke about this a lot last week. And what's actually very interesting is the way these are categorized. These Hellenizers are categorized in verses 1 through 15. So they did build a gymnasium, but what are we told? They tried to remove the marks of circumcision. So the commentator of the Anchor Bible, for sure, there would have been people who did this because everything in the gymnasium was done in the nude. And while most kind of, you know, Semitic peoples did circumcision, Greek culture did not like it, so the Seleucids would not have done circumcision, they would have looked down on it, and so people might have gone through a painful process to try and mask their circumcision. However, it is no doubt that it was very few and far between. So, but just as, you know, nowadays, someone hears, one person does something crazy, and before you know it, it's like, all of these people are doing this, that's basically what we get here. So all of the people who accept Hellenization are being characterized by, you know, they're all being tarred with the same brush. They are all, you know, everyone is assuming, oh, all of the Hellenists do this. Every single one of them just forsakes Brit Milah. They reverse their circumcision, however they do that. Where in reality, that probably very rarely happened. You know, pick your, you know, news outlet of choice and you will find, you know, people you don't like being described kind of similarly by their worst common denominator. That's basically what's happening here too. A lot of Hellenists weren't like this, There can also be, First Book of Maccabees is written much later than the actual Hanukkah story, so there can also be an element of cultural ignorance. The author of First Maccabees is inheriting the story from other people. Also, I remember, so I have cousins in Israel, and I remember when, I think I was 9, we made a trip, and it was the first time I properly met my cousins, and my cousin must have been like 7, but he's younger than me. He's 2 years younger, whether I was 9, he was 9, I don't remember which one. Either way, he's younger than me. And he asked very innocently, like, oh, do you do Christmas? Because he knew that we lived in England, and in England they celebrate Christmas, and he just assumed that it was a thing that was done, because we lived in a culturally different environment. And so if we accept some parts of the culture around us, we must accept all the parts of the culture around us. He meant no offense. He meant no... He wasn't even from an insulting place. It was just the innocent connection of someone who thinks, oh, you live in England, you adopt many aspects of English culture, that must mean you celebrate Christmas too. So there could also be that less nefarious description here of these people. They're clearly supposed to be bad, but the person could also be writing this from a bit of a point of innocence, in that this is what they heard all of these people did, and yeah, it kind of makes sense that they would do this, so that's what happens. The other thing that we read in the second paragraph, verses 16 through 19, was the attempt by Antiochus to capture Egypt. And indeed, this happened. This was a thing. But it's very much verse 16. When Antiochus saw that his kingdom was established, he determined to become king of the land of Egypt in order that he may reign over both kingdoms. He's very much characterized here as someone who's greedy, as someone who takes what isn't his. And the idea that Antiochus is treacherous and that he seizes things that don't belong to him is obviously very important, because what makes him part of the big bad in the story is that he decides to take control over things that aren't in his domain to control. And so, again, this is still, we're about to get into now the meat of the story, but this is still the introductory element. We painted all our pictures now. We know the entire kingdom is bad. We know the Jews who accept Hellenism are bad, and we know Antiochus is bad as a person and as a character, and is basically just not a complex figure here. He is about as evil as he can be. He's greedy, he's capricious, he's everything, and that sets up the meat of the story, which is basically the entire rest of the first chapter of the book of Maccabees. So now if we just take a couple of minutes to read that, and we can start talking about what we read there. All right, so there's, again, biblical parallels start going a bit crazy here, and we're only going to touch on a few of them. Again, even with just the English, some of them start to leap out, but obviously in the first kind of 5+ verses, we see again this sense that Antiochus is arrogant, he's literally described as it, and he just starts plundering the Beit HaMikdash. And this, again, picks up on the theme, he takes what isn't his right to take. There is another theme that runs through this first book of Maccabees, which is Antiochus is ultimately the rod of God's anger. You know, one of the major themes of the, if you think of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar is the classic example of this. Fascinatingly, God describes him in Yirmiyahu as Avdi, my servant. And Nebuchadnezzar is described in the same terms Moshe is described as. And Nebuchadnezzar will go on to destroy the first Beit HaMikdash, because there is obviously this theme that bad things are visited by other nations, and the Beit HaMikdash is sacked for a failure to observe God's law. Having already seen in that second paragraph that this is indeed the great sin of many of the Jewish people, the first book of Maccabees also has this very overt religious theme running through it. So we have, you know, a lot of different, very detailed what he takes from the second Beit HaMikdash. It should also be noted that the second Beit HaMikdash at this point was not particularly impressive a building. When we think of images of the second Beit HaMikdash, it's actually after Herod renovates, which is going to come much later in history. The second Beit HaMikdash at this point, as Ezra and Nehemiah tells us, they all cry when they see the people who've seen the first Beit HaMikdash cry seeing the second, because it just looks a bit pathetic. So at this point, the second Beit HaMikdash is not a particularly grand thing, which is also why we spoke about this last week. The selling off, which this skips over, the selling off of lots of its vessels hurts extra hard, because it probably had very little valuable things within it. And so the fact that those things are being taken is it wasn't like the first Beit HaMikdash or the renovated second Beit HaMikdash, which had more, you know, menorah than you could shake a stick at. You know, this barely has anything going on. So when something is plundered, it has that much more weight. From the perspective of history, and we spoke about this a bit last week, but one of the questions we maybe didn't address so well last week is, why does Antiochus come back in full force and to quash a rebellion? We spoke about last week, he's quashing a rebellion. He's busy conquering Egypt, and yet he decides to run back out of Egypt to try to quash a rebellion of a very small number of people in the land of Israel. What on earth motivates him to back out of this major conquest project in order to conquer the land, in order to kind of punish the people rebelling in the land of Israel? And it goes back to this idea that Antiochus is a usurper himself. And he knows more than anyone, and indeed the later history of the Seleucid Empire is, the second you vacate that throne, someone will try and sit on it in your stead. And if he's in Egypt, remember there was a false rumor spreading that he died in Egypt, which led to the rebellion to begin with. If people know you won't be able to be in your kingdom, it's like kind of like, you know, little kids where it's like, you know, if they don't have their hand on the chair is no longer theirs. It's that kind of thing. If he's not physically in his kingdom, very easy to be usurped. He himself was a hostage in Rome, and indeed he will eventually be usurped by his nephew, who is really the true heir to the throne, who himself has been a hostage in Rome, who will escape and eventually take the throne for himself. So it sounds crazy. He was invading Egypt. He was about to conquer this huge swath of land, and because of a tiny small amount of people, he decided to backtrack. But really, this is, he needs this to maintain his foothold on his kingdom. If he loses even one tiny area, then there's a chance that other areas could rebel also. And again, there's no clear evidence that Antiochus was particularly a tyrant, but definitely compared to the Persians, who were very nice, and to all their people, again, once one group of people rebels, it inspires all the other people to rebel as well. So he has a lot of reasons for coming back. If you take a look at verse 25, where we just simply say Israel mourned deeply in every community, and you look at the additional sheet. So Megillat Esther does get riffed. Larry, you already pointed out, Megillat Esther is one of the books that's very much riffed here. Notably, the Book of Maccabees does not refer to the name of God like Megillat Esther, but we have reference to every community is mourning, as we have here. V'chol medinah medinah mekom asher dvar hamelech v'dato magia. Eval gadol la Yehudim v'tzom uv'chiu mispeit sak va'efa yutzal arabim. Everyone is mourning. Everyone is swept up in mourning. That same theme carries through here to the Book of Maccabees, and later, like, Antiochus would have communicated via letters, but it's a very conscious choice that we read a bit later on in this paragraph that he communicates via letters, which is obviously how Ahasuerus communicates everything in the Purim story. So again, it's a clear and obvious reference. As you'd expect at this point in the story, the strongest biblical allusions are to Megillat Eicha, are to the Book of Lamentations, and indeed a lot of the prophetic, a lot of the prophecies that surround destruction. So when we read in verse 26, rulers and elders groaned, young women and young men became fate, the beauty of the women faded, and if we see in verse 3, is source 3 on the additional source sheet, and Yashvula Aretz Yidmu Ziknei Vatzion, the elders of Tzion are sat on the ground, and Helu Afal Rosham, ash on their head, Chagu Sakim, they've girded themselves with sackcloth, Harudula Aretz Roshan, Betulot Yerushalayim, the maidens of Yerushalayim have bowed their heads to the ground. This description of just abject mourning in the wake of destruction, and again, the number of references you see in this paragraph. Two, that clearly riff of, if you just look at kind of 38 through 40, you know, Yerushalayim became a dwelling of strangers, she became strange to her offspring, her children have forsaken her sanctuary is desolate, her feasts turn into mourning, her dishonor is now great. I mean, if you were to see those words, you'd be like, oh, that's definitely taken from Eicha, right? That must be, that is literally describing the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. So very clear and consciously, taking note here of Megillat Eicha here to describe what's going on. Something really, really cool also to note, in verse 37, where it describes the defiling of the sanctuary, so there is a Mishnah in Masechet Midot, which says, if you take a look at the additional source sheet, source number 4, Ushlosh Esrei Paratzot Hayusham, Sheparatzum Malchei Yavan, that there were 13 breaches in it, I didn't put the bit of the Mishnah which describes what it is. I'll explain what it is in a second. But the, you know, the kings of Yavan, the Seleucid kings, made 13 breaches. This was the partition, the lattice work. In the Beit HaMikdash, there was an area that was like, no non-Jewish people beyond this point. Because non-Jewish people were allowed to go into the Beit HaMikdash, but past a certain point, they were not allowed to go any further. So one way in which they defiled the Beit HaMikdash was by not respecting that don't cross the yellow line. And indeed, they punched through. They burst through that lattice work. They, you know, they slashed it, they destroyed it, they basically made it non-existent. Something that Chazal themselves still have this memory of that they're describing in the Mishnah and Midot. So the defilement is just the total and utter disregard and disrespect of the Beit HaMikdash. Given the time and given that chapter 2 is really, really important, at this point we will pause to read the entirety of chapter 2, which is a lot, but let's read it all in one go, and then we'll pick up all of the really, really fascinating biblical allusions, because chapter 2 is really where the first book of Maccabees starts to create its own narrative within the story of Hanukkah. All right. If everything in the first chapter sets up the story, but more or less conforms to what we know to have happened historically, chapter 2 is the significant... After chapter 2, things again start to hew pretty historical. Chapter 2 is really the major key chapter in the whole book of Maccabees that from which we can understand its entire theme and purpose. In the actual Hanukkah story, historically, we still know a lot about Matityahu, and we know a lot of his personality, as captured in this, you know, Perek also. This chapter really does help us understand Matityahu. But you have to remember, he started the rebellion and he died pretty quickly after that, which we already see in this story, but he is the original figure, but he's not necessarily, historically speaking, the actual guy who does the stuff. However, the first book of Maccabees here really paints a very dramatic, powerful picture of Matityahu that is so much larger than life, that it's obviously way too unbelievable. The reality is that, and I was thinking about this, you know, when you're a kid and you want to be a superhero, you can't just settle on being one superhero. You can't just settle on being Spider-Man. So you want to be a combination of Spider-Man, Batman, and The Flash, with also the ability to fly. You know, you want all of those things. What this Perek does is usually what you do. If you are writing a later biblical book, is you pick one or two models from earlier in biblical history and you weave those themes into your book. So Megillat Esther, for example, mainly Yosef. Also Shaul, King Saul, a bit of Moshe, but like that's it. It's a very delicate recipe. It borrows heavily from the story of Yosef. It borrows heavily also from the story of Daniel, all things that would kind of make sense. It's a delicate balance. It makes it work. This is kind of like, and it's very explicit, like, it does it subtly, and then it just starts doing it explicitly. This is like, let's do everyone. Just start naming biblical characters. It was, you know, a few seconds away from Noach. If he wrote any more verses, you know, it would be Noach too. That being said, just as with your superhero concoction, you still got to decide what your superhero looks like. So you have to pick, it'll look like Spider-Man, just with the bat ears and the speed of the Flash and the ability to fly. Matityahu most fits Pinchas. Pinchas, whom, if you take a look at source number 5, so you'll remember it's actually, we are introduced to Pinchas at the end of Parashat Balak, but then he gets his own parasha. So the Jewish people are sinning with the Midianites, and they are told, don't do this. But nonetheless, as we read in source 5, Vihine ish mi b'nei Yisrael ba vayakriv el echav et hamidyanit, he brings a Midianite woman into the camp. He brings it before everyone, just to, you know, prove to everyone that he can do this. Moshe and everyone there just sat weeping. They don't know what to do. Who would actually do this? This is horrible. Vayar Pinchas, ben Elazar, ben Aharon, HaKohen. Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aharon, who was a Kohen. Vayakam mitocha eda vayikach romach biyado, he takes a spear. Vayavo acha ish Yisrael el hakuba vayidko et shnehem et ish Yisrael vet haisha el kavata vatiyatsa hamagefa me'al b'nei Yisrael. He stabs them both with his giant spear. And thus the plague ends. Pinchas is without a doubt, I don't want to say without a doubt, because you could maybe find other people, but Pinchas is one of the most complicated heroes in the Torah, because it's very clear that the Torah itself is both, you know, God is both thumbs up to what he did, but also like, never do that again. You know, kind of thing. Nonetheless, Matityahu, or the author of the first book of Maccabees, sees only the good in Pinchas. Take a look, by the way, at verse 1. So remember, Pinchas is Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen. In those days, Matityahu, son of John, son of Shimon, HaKohen. The riff is explicit. Matityahu is introduced, and Pinchas is uniquely introduced. I don't want to say uniquely because it's never unique, but Pinchas is famously introduced with this kind of, you know, way. He's referred to as Pinchas ben Aharon, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen. That is how Pinchas is described. Matityahu is described as such. There's another really important reason for using Pinchas as the model. There are two crucial reasons. Pinchas ignores the religious leaders and does his own thing and is approved of by God. And second, Pinchas is rewarded with the priesthood. The Hashmonaim do something that in the eyes of the Hasidim, the eyes of the religious community, is wrong in going to war. We spoke about this last week, in being violent in trying to achieve salvation. And they also seize the high priesthood, which was never theirs to take. So the model of Matityahu as Pinchas not only legitimizes the extremism of the Hashmonaim, of the Maccabees, but also legitimizes what they will later do, which is appoint themselves high priests. They are already Kohanim. But the idea that now they are in charge, just as God gives Pinchas his Brit Shalom, he gives him the Kohuna, he makes him a priest, so too do the Hashmonaim use Pinchas as the model, because again, it's like, well, he did it, and we do it too. Obviously, later in the story, if you just quickly flick to verse 23, when he had finished speaking these words, the Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice on the altar in Modi'in, according to the king's command. When Matityahu saw it, he burned with zeal and his heart was stirred. He gave vent to righteous anger. He ran and killed him on the altar. You don't do that. At the same time, he killed the king's officer who was forcing them to sacrifice, and he tore down the altar just in case. You missed that very clear allusion. Thus he burned with zeal for the Lord, just as Pinchas did against Zimri, son of Salu. This is so important for the author of 1 Maccabees to get through that he doesn't want to be subtle. Just in case you miss it. Just in case you realize you are reading it in the Hebrew and you get all of the clear, explicit allusions to Pinchas and other biblical figures, we're just going to put it out there, you know, flashing bright red letters on the TV screen. This is a reference to, you know, it's like sometimes you watch movies that say address political events and you're like, oh, we see what they're doing. And then at the end of the movie, during the credit scene, they show you the actual political events and you were like, it was so subtle before then, it was good. But now you're literally showing me the explicit things you are riffing off. Now it just looks a bit too on the nose. That's what's happening here. This very explicit reference. But it's not just Pinchas, whom Matityahu is compared to, obviously. And we'll get there. But first, I mentioned this last week, that Maccabees as a term, it's very unclear what it is, because Maccabees itself doesn't come up, really. You see it does come up in verse 4 here. Judah was Maccabeus. But it's just in all their names. If you look at verse 2, he had 5 sons: John, Gadi, Shimon, Tassi, Judah, Maccabee, Elazar, Avaran, and Yonatan, Athus. What exactly all of those are in the actual Hebrew, but this is in a world without surnames, without last names, and so you kind of just got given one. You got a cool one. You got a fun one. It's kind of like nowadays, and none of you will appreciate this, but basically, Brazilian, Portuguese soccer players never actually go by their actual name, because often in the Portuguese, you have like 4 last names. So they choose a nickname. So, you know, the original Ronaldo, it's a nickname. There's a player from Manchester United right now whose nickname is Fred, which is like, he was at the end of the nickname list to have chosen Fred. Like, most of them have these, but, you know, you look at, like, any, like, Pele, you know, the most famous Brazilian player. That's not his name. His name is, like, just four very normal names strung together. And so, you know, on his, you know, a lot of them, if they have Enio, it's because Enio is like a diminutive. So they were like the little version of someone else. Same thing used to happen here. In a world where naming conventions are different, you have to do something else instead. So Maccabee was simply Yehuda's nickname, but becomes the name of everything.
So it's not like today where people would have an English name and a Hebrew name. In many cases, it's different.
Well, here they only have Hebrew names. Or if they have, some of them actually have Greek names. And we talked about last week how Jason, who's one of the Kohen Gadols, changes his name. He Hellenizes it. It was Yeshua or Yehoshua, and the English translation of that is Jesus. But the Hellenization of that is Jason. It's the same, all three are the same name. Yehoshua, the hey is so easy to drop that Yehoshua just becomes Yeshua. It was a very popular name in Beit Sheni, and Yeshua Hellenizes to Jason. Anglicizes or Latinizes, I don't know, to Jesus, but it's all the same, like, name. They all had very common names. They all have biblical names. You know, there's only so many names you can give your kid a name if you're looking into Tanakh. So, you know, Matityahu has, I don't know exactly what John would be, but John, which is a popular Beit Sheni Greek name, Yochanan.
Oh, Yochanan, right.
Yochanan.
Yochanan is one of the, right.
There you go. You have Shimon, you have Yehuda.
Jason could be like Yosef.
Yeah, but this Jason, we, you know, is, but it's as in, you do get certain, just as Moses is Moshe, and sometimes you have these slightly more, you know, how does this become this? Jason was Yeshua, but that was Yehoshua, the name. If you Hellenized it, it became, you know, Jason. Don't ask me why, but that is how it worked. But that is the thing. So basically, they gave themselves last names. You start to see again the Purim story coming through again, them putting on sackcloth and ashes publicly. They ask Matityahu to kind of be the first to do something, and he refuses, which is obviously a riff on Mordechai refusing to bow down to Haman. Just as Mordechai is leader of the Jews, so too is Matityahu leader of the Jews. Both of them take a principled religious stance here. Then we get the Pinchas story. And again, there are so many biblical allusions, but at a certain point, there's only so many you can be bothered putting on an additional source sheet. But this one is actually very cool. Verse 27. Yeah. Then Matityahu cried out in the town with a loud voice, saying, "Let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me." Take a look at source 6 on the additional source sheet. During Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, Vaya'amod Moshe b'sha'ahaman machaneh v'yomer, Mi l'Adonai Eli, whoever for God is with me, Vayesvu alav kol b'nei Levi, gathers the b'nei Levi, and they basically kill everyone. So again, Moshe is an important model because he too takes to violent means in order to quash problematic things, but also there are few people, if you can compare yourself to Moshe, then you are good. So the idea here that Matityahu is not just Pinchas, Matityahu is Mordechai. Matityahu is Moshe. That is, you know, that's a pretty big group of people. And the fleeing to the hills. So some people point out this is riffs of David HaMelech, who also has to flee to the hills. So again, add that to the list. He's now also a kind of a, you know, following in the footsteps of David HaMelech too. Then we actually get the story which I spoke about last week, that remember, it's not just the Hashmonaim, the Maccabees, are not the only religious Jews in town. The Hasidim are also, and they refuse to fight on Shabbat. They refuse to descend themselves, so they get slaughtered. So we get that story here that they are attacked on Shabbat. That is something that would happen, and that is what swayed a lot of people to the Maccabee cause. And then if you just take a look at kind of verse 46, just a reminder that Matityahu, they're not the nicest people. They forcibly circumcised all the uncircumcised boys that they found within the land of Israel. Like, these are, they have extreme methods of doing what they do. And again, they are so anti anything, you know, anything Hellenistic, anything Greek culture, that they'll destroy everything. So you have at this point this group of Hellenized Jews, because again, this story has conflated what is a pretty relatively decent period of time. So any of these young boys who've not been circumcised, they're doing it themselves. One does not want to imagine, but I imagine hygiene was not high up on their list. Then beginning...
But also, if the Greeks found these babies that had been circumcised, they would kill the babies.
That's true also.
So this is not... It's not like saying, we ask you to join us. You are condemning those babies.
Yeah, they're forcing everyone to choose their side. Yeah, that's a really good point.
But they didn't ask them to choose.
Correct. I'm saying they're forcing them to be on that. You know, if you are someone living in this area and you've not circumcised your kid for fear of death, they're forcing you to be on the Hashmoni side. You know, one way is you get people to join you. The other way is you force them to be on your side. Because now, if you are the parent of a kid who's now been circumcised, you have to hope the Hashmoneim win because that's your only chance of survival. And then we get to Parashat Vayechi. And so Parashat Vayechi, which comes right at the end of Sefer Bereishit, which is Yaakov's deathbed scene, and we get here with verses 49 on. And we have, at this point, Matityahu himself is giving the charge to the people, and he runs through the list of all the biblical figures, and there's actually something really fascinating here, which is the biblical figures chosen. In verse 52, we get Abraham. It makes sense. Abraham is told to sacrifice his kid. So basically, the Hashmoneim, or Matityahu, is urging the Hashmoneim, you should be willing to sacrifice yourselves and your children for this cause. Again, follow the model of Abraham. Really, really fascinating is the choice of Yosef as a model here. Because this is pointed out, James Kugel has the book In Potiphar's House, which is a pretty old book. But I was recently reading it, and he points out here, it's really weird that Yosef is a model here, because the entire idea here, which is the story of him resisting Potiphar's wife, is not actually within a lot of the elaboration. It's not within the text itself. A lot of it is elaborated midrashically. But Yosef's willingness to resist temptation became, in the Bayit Sheni period, a very major theme. So Yosef, who, you know, we think of Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Yosef kind of is a tier two biblical figure almost. But in Bayit Sheni period, for the Book of Maccabees, Yosef is tier one, because Yitzchak and Yaakov don't make the list because they didn't face, you know, the same kinds of tests. They didn't face the same challenges. So we actually almost get here, fascinatingly, this is the list of, from the Maccabee perspective, who are the tier one biblical figures. Pinchas, Abraham, Yosef, Yehoshua and Kalev, obviously, because they also stand up to everyone and do what's right, and they risk their lives in the process. They are countercultural forces, which is what Matityahu is seeing himself as, or what the Book of Maccabees is seeing him as. Eliyahu, who's also obviously very much, you know, a zealot, the idea that he is Pinchas, because the two of them have different ways of establishing their zealotry, but they're both very passionate for their causes. And then Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael, and Daniel, who are obviously all people living in foreign lands willing to die for their Jewish beliefs. So what Matityahu basically does here, and really what the first book of Maccabees puts into Matityahu's mouth, is the legitimacy of the Hashmonai rebellion.
Also, you skipped David.
Oh yeah, because I mentioned David earlier, yeah.
Right, because that gives him the legitimacy of taking the throne back.
Yes, and David was not afraid to get his hands dirty.
Right.
David himself led a civil war. David himself conquered the throne. You know, David literally is too bloodthirsty. You know, he is seen, you know, as a very, you know, there is blood on his hands. He's very much a, you know.
He's a fighter. How does he like Yosef?
How Yosef resists Potiphar's wife. So this is the only. So they are resisting the temptation of Hellenization. So it's that idea. Yeah. Yosef is a weird choice because he's the only one on the list not a fighter. So again, the more interesting question is, how did Yosef end up on this list of fighters, which tells us a lot about how he was perceived of in Bayit Sheni, but we can just reverse that equation to be like, they saw him as a fighter, and that's why he makes this list. Yes, sir.
Well, it goes beyond just resisting Potiphar's wife. Wasn't the whole idea that even in Egypt, he kept kosher, and he kept separate, you know, And so that's also part of it, is there's all this pressure, even for it being put in jail and everything, all this pressure to become like the Egyptians. He didn't do it. He managed to work with it, but he didn't become one of them.
Yeah. And so
when Joseph in the Sefer Bereshit, he is really he dressed like an Egyptian.
Yeah.
He dressed like an Egyptian, but I believe the Midrash talks about
So this is what's interesting, and this is where this is where we get a bit more into the Kugel side of things, which I don't really want to delve into too much. But Yosef as a biblical figure doesn't do that much. He's Egyptian. We don't read of any of this stuff. The Midrashim go into great lengths about how much he preserved his Judaism, one of which was also this willingness to resist temptation. What's really interesting, and kind of Kugel argues, is this was the thing. And the fourth book of Maccabees really doubles down on this. We're not getting into that because, you know, once you get to the book four of something, it's like, no, you could have done a trilogy. It would have been good. Four is just, you know, stop. Exactly. So, but the point was, this is the remarkable thing about Yosef is, and this is what kind of starts Kugel's book off. The remarkable thing about the Yosef story is what the interpretation of the Yosef story is, his resistance of temptation. Not the other stuff everyone is fascinated by, the attempted seduction by Potiphar's wife. I do want to kind of finish talking about Sefer Maccabim, though, and then we can talk more about Yosef, but I want to...
It's very funny, the resist Hellenization. The Jews in America are American. They celebrate Thanksgiving. They are quite Americanized. Is the story of the Book of Maccabees this fundamentalist reaction was really successful? Is going to last the time? Is possible that the Asmonean was not so nice people because they are going to usurp the priesthood? Is it really possible that has been so successful when they return from the first exile, the majority of the Jews are going to stay in Babylon.
Yeah.
So, there is more Jews in the state, almost now, or in New York, than in the state of Israel. So, is it so nice over there, if we need to really to bring back a theocracy, let's go. What are we doing here in adult education? Let's go there. But it doesn't happen like this.
Yes. So this is really, you know, opens into what the first book of Maccabees is there to do, which is justify the Hashmonaim. Because they are not, and we'll see this next week when we talk about the second book of Maccabees, they are clearly and obviously debated heroes during this era. This is written after they have seized the throne completely, and so they control both the priesthood and the kingship. And they are not well liked. The rest of the Book of Maccabees just basically tells you the history of the story with, you know, other things kind of, you know, more like chapter one than chapter two. But the whole point of chapter two is to emphasize the entire and complete legitimacy of the Hashmonaei project, in that they were the ultimate, Matityahu was the ultimate embodiment of all of the good biblical heroes, just as Pinchas was rewarded by God, and David, and all of these other people did their things. Moshe turned violent. You know, all of these people had to do these things. So too are they justified. There's one other really cool thing that people point out about the first book of Maccabees, which I just have to draw your attention to, which is verse 63. So actually, let's pick it up, 62. 62 on the previous page. Do not fear the words of sinners, for their splendor will turn into dung and worms. Verse 63. Today they will be exalted, but tomorrow they will not be found, because they will have returned to the dust and their plans will have perished. So people attach a lot of significance to these words, because something that is strangely missing from the characterization of Matityahu, for all that he seems to be characterized as an ultimate religious personality. And if you contrast it with other biblical books which describe similar situations of, you know, the acceptance of martyrdom, is the resurrection of the dead. number one theme in most books that deal with persecution is the dead will be resurrected. Matityahu does not talk about this. The first book of Maccabees is almost screaming loudly in its silence, the acknowledgement of the resurrection of the dead. And part of that makes a lot of sense because resurrection of the dead is the number one way to encourage martyrdom. Denying the resurrection of the dead is the number one way to encourage people to pick up a sword and fight. Because if you're going to convince people that, you know, there is no second time at this, you don't get a second shot. You've got to try and fight for your lives. The classic response of martyrdom always was to emphasize resurrection. That's the tragic reality of Jewish history. A major theme, it becomes such an overt and extreme theme throughout so much of Jewish history is because that was how you went to sleep at night. But for Matityahu, that is not an idea he wants to accept. That is not an idea he is going to emphasize. And so as next week we will talk more about why Chazal did not like the Chashmonaim, another thing that's often picked up on here is that Matityahu didn't even believe in what was one of Chazal's core beliefs, which was Techiyat HaMetim, that Matityahu seems to accept the end of life is at death. And that is just one more reason for him to be characterized as a less than positive figure in the second book of Maccabees and going on. But what we see from the first book of Maccabees is the perspective of Matityahu as the ideal Jew, at least in the sense of the fighting Jew, and the fact that everything Matityahu did with his rebellion, despite the fact that the Hasidim, the quote-unquote from Jews, did not originally want to rebel, despite the fact that so much of what Matityahu did and what his descendants would do seems to go against so many things that, you know, were supposed to have happened, nonetheless, the first book of Maccabees sets out very clearly from the beginning, this is legitimate. The rebellion was legitimate, and the descendants of Matityahu, following Pinchas, are allowed to claim the high priesthood, and given that they, at the end of the day, went to war with an illegitimate king who had conquered the true king, you know, of the time that had been foretold by God Dariavesh, that their ascension to the throne is really just the unusurping. Their ascension to the throne is really correct and proper and true. And thus, First Maccabees exists. You could describe it as its own form of propaganda. It's Hasmonean propaganda in order to convince its readers that the Chashmonai kingship and priesthood were good, were the good guys, were only following in the footsteps of all the admirable biblical figures. However, the counter to that perspective is found in the second book of Maccabees, which we will talk about next week, which takes the same story and yet goes in completely different directions in order to conclude, make the complete opposite conclusions. And we'll also talk next week about why Chazal, at the end of the day, hated the Chashmonaim.